Good morning again. So we're still with John the Baptist because he's the one that's preparing the way for Jesus. And like we said last week, this is a time of year where we prepare ourselves for the birth of Jesus as well as look ahead to his return. So the interesting thing about John the Baptist is that, like pretty much everybody else, he doesn't really get the whole picture, which is weird because you think that he would. He's John the Baptist, and he's had some kind of relationship with Jesus for, you kind of have to like read between the lines, but for a long time. And so there's one like pertinent question to this whole section, and we can tell that it's the one that Luke wants us to be thinking about because of its repetition. He says, "Are you the one who is to come, or should we look for another?" And it's usually, in the Bible anyway, a kind of a clear indication that that's what the writer wants you to be thinking about because of what's called like an economy of words. Like, this isn't some, like, giant Tolstoy novel that's 1,000 pages. Luke is really short. You can read it in maybe an hour and a half at most if you're like me and a slow reader. And so if they repeat something, they're doing it very, very carefully. And so John, he's at this point, he's in prison because of some conflict that he had with Herod Antipas, one of Herod the Great's sons. Basically, he had shacked up with his brother's sister, and John said, "Hey, don't do that." And so, like any good tyrant, he locked him up. And so, you get the sense that John is a little confused by Jesus. And I think he's confused because Jesus isn't living up to his expectations. The general expectation, very broadly speaking, very large conversation truncated into like 20 seconds, is that the one who is to come is supposed to beat up the bad guys, solve all of our problems, restore the nation. And if that sounds familiar, like uphold national values, solve all our problems, beat up the bad guys, you may be saying, "Well, isn't that Superman?" And that's, one theologian will call Superman a Christological heresy. I don't go that far. But there is a sense in which we like to think about Jesus as though he were a superhero. Someone who just shows up from another planet, solves our problems. And Jesus doesn't do that directly. So, Jesus could have, as John's disciples are asking him this, could have said, yes. But Jesus being Jesus has this tendency to basically never answer a question directly. And if you want to irritate people, do that. But Jesus doesn't seem to care about that. So he, instead of answering directly, he then gets to work. He performs these miraculous healings, and we have them listed there, as if to say to the disciples, "Now who do you say I am?" Because it's one thing for Jesus to just say, "Yeah, that's me." Because then that's Jesus' answer. Now, Jesus being Jesus would be right. But it's not their answer. This is a very like typical like first century Jewish way of talking. Jesus is less interested in giving them an answer, and he wants their answer to be their answer. So put yourselves in their minds or in their sandals, I guess. Jesus then does all of these things and then says, "Go tell John what you see." In other words, ball's in your court. What do you think's happening right now? Now, if you were them, you were starting to think, okay, so that was special. Blind people were seeing, like people who had all kinds of physical ailments were being healed, evil spirits cast out. Okay, something's going on and it's breaking the categories that I thought I had. And now these two disciples, on their however long journey back to John the Baptist, probably had a lot to talk about and then report back. Based on how the story plays out, it's very likely that they end up joining Jesus. And maybe that's one of the difficult aspects of preparing ourselves for the birth of Jesus. Because it's Christmas, and Christmas is steeped in tradition. It's steeped in kind of repetition. You often do the same things every year. At least if you're part of my family, we watch mostly the same set of movies every year at certain times. You'll eat very similar things. You'll eat dinner on Christmas Day with usually at least a small pool of people that you'll kind of pull from. And so Christmas becomes very samey. That's a word I made up. Same-ish, that doesn't sound better. It becomes maybe a better word is familiar. And familiarity breeds unfamiliarity. And the more familiar we think we get with Christmas and the Christmas story, the more things slip through. Because we just start assuming we know. And that makes it really difficult for Christmas and the celebration of the birth of Jesus to break down the categories that we may have learned to apply to Jesus. Now, Jesus then kind of flips the script. He then turns to the people and he starts talking about John. He's like a hype man. He hypes him up and said, "When you went out into the wilderness, what did you think you were going to see? A reed shaken by the wind? Someone wearing fine, luxurious clothes." No, man, if you're wearing that, like, that's the thing kings wear. Now, this is very loaded language. Because based on the coinage that we have found, the reed, there was a special kind of reed that would grow all around the Sea of Galilee. And that became the symbol on the coinage produced by Herod Antipas. And so Jesus, in just a very sort of, well, it's subtle to us because we're removed, but I think the crowd would have got it immediately, was pitting Herod Antipas and John the Baptist, saying, like, okay, you've got this king who wears fine clothes and he's very much a tyrant, just like his father. And then you have John the Baptist, who exhibits true strength, real strength. He's not a reed that gets just bent by the wind. And then he goes on to say, this is in fact the guy who prepares the way for the Messiah, which is one of the closer ways that Jesus will actually say, I am in fact the one you were waiting for. And then he flips the script again. John the Baptist, he's like the greatest guy ever born of a woman, which is like everybody. But then he says, but the least of the person, or the least person, the lowest person on the totem pole, so to speak, in the kingdom of God is the greatest. Jesus taking categories and then turning them upside down. So what categories do we put around Christmas that need to be broken up? That's a really hard question to ask because here's where, you know, toes get stepped on and that kind of thing. But what assumptions do we make about the Christmas story? What things are we sure about or do we just know about? We roll our eyes, yeah, there were shepherds there, and yeah, there was, you know, he's in a manger, and okay, all of, and the magi who bring these gifts. And we can go through the story because those stories are really hard or really easy to misunderstand, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about them. But I'm going to hone in on one of them, and I'm not going to explain why, and you can ask me later if you're curious. The birth of Jesus, like that moment when Mary gives birth, is far more ordinary than our collective imaginations would think. He wasn't born in a stable. There's no textual evidence for that. He wasn't born in a cave. That idea comes from the Protoevangelion of James, some text that was written about it was written in the 200s. Google it. Or don't. He was born in a house, and houses had extra rooms. And the way Luke tells it, it was too small, and so they just put him in a manger that they happened to have in the main room because everyone would bring their animals in at night, and a hungry animal is an annoying animal. And if you have cats, you understand this deeply. And so they just, I mean, that was the soft spot. So they just lay him there. She was probably surrounded by the village midwives. Nobody would have turned them away. I can't imagine a scenario, even in the modern world, where a woman is giving birth, shows up at a house, and someone says, yeah, you can go in the shed in the back. No, that's not how this works. Like, when the shepherd showed up, if they had found that somebody had did this, they would have beaten him and run him out of town. That's their culture. Our culture is probably similar. In other words, the time comes, Mary starts having contractions, Joseph, if he's like any other guy, goes, I have no idea what's going on. I'll be reassured, as reassuring as I can from a safe distance, and I'm going to stand in the corner, you know, away from arm's reach, and if you know, you know. And I'm going to let everyone else take care of this, and like any other birth, it's a bloodbath. And then at the end, there's a very normal-looking baby screaming his head off because you have to get those lungs going and get everything out. And then only Mary and Joseph really know in that moment that God has done something that nobody saw coming. That will be extraordinary, and that nobody at this point really knows where this story is going to go. The Christmas story is this beautiful blend of intensely ordinary and normal moments combined with this extraordinary intersection of divinity and flesh. And this boy will grow up, and he will start to make waves. And he will start to reveal that God is doing something that nobody sees coming. That he is taking on the story of his people, the people of Israel, who by their own admission will say is a story of brokenness, of heroes failing miserably, of ordinary everyday people doing great things only to reveal their own deeply scarred humanity. And by taking on this story of Israel, he is very directly taking on your story, my story, the story of humanity, which is filled with broken, ordinary people occasionally doing extraordinary things and then showing us that human nature is something none of us can escape. And this story will have a trajectory, because if you are taking on the story of humanity, how will all of our stories end? Will end in death. But his death will have immense significance, because he, like a sponge, absorbs all of the darkness and evil in the human hearts, and he will let it exhaust itself onto him. And all of that would be fine and completely insignificant if he hadn't walked out of that tomb 3 days later. The story of Christmas is the story of humanity passing from death to life. It's an upsetting of those categories. It's a moment when divinity and flesh intersect in a way that nobody sees coming. I'm willing to bet, as you sit down to eat your Christmas ham or turkey or what, tofu if you're vegetarian or whatever, I don't know, tofurkey or whatever they call it. I'm willing to bet, and honestly I hope, those categories aren't going through your mind usually. But I pray for all of us as we sit down to dinner in like 9 days, that you sit down to a meal and recognize this is the story. We are eating in celebration. We are eating in celebration of the story of humanity passing from death to life in this singular moment of the person whose birth we are celebrating. Amen.